Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, Blog Talk Radio. This is Russell. We are back again. And once again, we have Jerrion with us, and she's raring to go. She says she has a big message for all of us to save our souls. You highly recommend Saving Jesus, that book by Michael Legwin, right? You think that needs to be replaced? The Bible needs to be replaced by that book?
I don't think we can ever replace the Bible, but I certainly think it should have equal value for the purpose of learning and doing what Christ asked us all to do. And, you know, he was quite clear about it. In one sentence, he said, "Be ye perfect as your Father in heaven is perfect." And at another time, in fact, three other times, he said to us, "Everything that I can do, you can do, and more." And the Saving Jesus book by Michael Ledwith actually walks you through the process, walks your brain through the process, if you like, and brings to your consciousness the ability to fulfill that admonition of Christ, namely to learn how to do the things that he could do and to actually do them, both for yourself and for others. So it is quite a remarkable book, and where we can get ongoing support and information all our lives from the Bible, we can also get a great deal of how to do it for yourself information from Michael Ledwith's book, Saving Jesus. So yes, I think it's an absolutely remarkable book.
All right. I'm looking at Hebrews 11:11. Faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of not seen. Could you go over that for us?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear what you said, Russ. I think I'm having a problem with the sound here. Can you say that again, please?
Okay. Can you hear me now?
Yes, that's better.
Okay. I'm at Hebrews 11:11. Faith, the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. Explain that for us.
Evidence of things hoped for, things not seen. Well, I don't know how I would explain that, Russell. How would you explain it?
I would say, basically, if you don't have faith, then you can't really do too much on this planet. You got to have faith. Even though you don't see it, it hasn't come to fruition. But if you have faith that it will happen, I think somehow, and you talked about it earlier, about that quantum energy idea, that you can bring it to you if you have faith as a grain of a mustard seed. And say unto the mountain, "Be thou removed, and be thou cast into the sea, and it will do as you say." I mean, that's strong information. I mean, that's a strong pronouncement.
Yes, and I think it's absolutely true. As you know, I'm no bibliophile, as you are, and so I maybe come at things from a slightly different point of view. But I totally agree with you that faith is the ultimate thing to be desired in order to achieve whatever it is that's in our hearts and minds to achieve. And this is all the way from the, you know, self-help gurus who say your affirmations and believe in yourself, right? Well, the extension of that, of course, is also believing in those of higher authority, those beings who are maybe extraterrestrial, as Christ himself, of course, was an extraterrestrial, or in the ultimate, in God himself, that you have to, even though you don't see Christ on a daily basis and you don't see God, you have to have faith in the knowledge that they are there, that just because you don't see them doesn't mean that they don't exist. And we know that this is true from a basic science, that there are many, many things that we are physically incapable of actually seeing, like quarks, for example, in the quantum field. But we know now scientifically that they do exist and that we can trust in that existence because it is scientifically based. I don't think there is anything in the universe that cannot or will not at some point in our understanding be explainable in an absolutely logical way, because I totally think and believe that the Creator is logical. Whatever else the creation might, it is logical. And just think about it from the very simplest things. You know, it is logical that you put a seed in the ground and it grows and grows into the whatever the seed was. It doesn't grow into something else. There is a pattern to everything in the universe. There is a balance. Nature is forever seeking balance in the universe. So I don't think you have to be religious in a church-going sense or in a believing sense to accept the fact that that yes, things will work out because there is a pattern to them, and there is a striving throughout all creation to find balance both within your own body and within the great universe itself. Faith, I do not think, is a matter of religion. And it shouldn't necessarily be a matter of belief, even though it is in a way, because it's accepting things that you can't see, but knowing that they are there. And I think the key word in what I just said is knowing, that you should be constantly striving to understand that which is being presented to you by the world, by the Bible, by the science books, by anything that comes to you, by trying to understand it and gain knowledge from it, we get closer and closer to manifesting what we take on faith. And so King Knowledge, I think, is an absolute key factor. With that in mind, I think we can also look at books like the Bible. The Bible itself, as you know, is not one book. It's several books put together by men who have since claimed it is the word of God. And yet that book comes from many people. It was written a long time after the times it talks about. Much of the Bible was written 200 to 600 years after the time they were claiming, the time of Adam and the Garden of Eden. And of course, the descriptions in Genesis of Adam and Eve and the Garden of Eden are themselves a story which was written a long time before, possibly thousands of years before, put together by the Sumerians. And it was the story that they were told by the people who instigated their cultures, namely the Anunnaki, at the time they were on the planet. And that was thousands of years before the story that they were telling. So the Bible is a composite of all these stories that are spread over several thousand years at least, and compiled and edited and put together by men. And the stories that are in there, especially in the later date as time progresses with the Bible stories, the stories that are in there were chosen from all the stories that were available. They were the ones that were chosen to support the belief structures of the people who were putting the books together. So it's really a hodgepodge of history, none of it necessarily very accurate. But I think that if we are willing to open our minds a bit and take another look at some of the words that we use in relation to the Bible, for example, you know, the big one obviously is that we have reference to gods, with an S on the end, plural, gods, plural, who walked in the garden and discussed together. And of course, we do know from archaeological and historical fact that those particular gods that they were referring to were the Enki or the Enlil. Now, the Enki, another name associated with the Enki is Samael. And another name associated with Samael is, of course, Lucifer. And so here you have an interesting idea, because in the pictorial stories of Adam and Eve, you have the Enki depicted as a serpent in the garden. He subsequently becomes known as Lucifer or Satan, right? So you're taking somebody who was simply an administrator on the planet, the one who separated the waters from the land, primarily by ordering the digging of ditches in much the same way as Hollanders do today to hold the sea back from the land. And that was his big engineering feat. Above all else, the Enki was a scientist, an engineer, and he was in charge of the management of the planet. And from that, he became known in the Bible down the line, whether we recognize it or not. The same Yahweh in the garden is the Samael, who is the Lucifer, who becomes the Satan. And these names are all connected. In the same way, you have the Enlil, of course, who becomes Jehovah. And Jehovah was the one who was going to allow all humanity to drown in the flood. And the Enki, the bad one, he was the one who saved humanity through his son Noah, by telling him to build, the ark and save the people and save the animals. So I think what happens here is that when we are young, when I was young, when I was six, I was given as a Christmas gift a book called Bible Stories for Young Folk. When I was eight, I was given a book called Lamb's Tales from Shakespeare. Then when I was 11 and went to high school, I was given a regular Bible of my own, and I was given a complete works of William Shakespeare of my own, because it was considered now I didn't need just the stories. I needed to read the originals, the full version. And I think we are, again, as a people, as humanity, at the point where we are ready for the full version. The full version being all the disclosures that are going on now, all the things that are coming out. For example, Ezekiel mentions the wheels within wheels, the concept of Jacob's ladder, the going up and down to heaven, these extraterrestrial beings. It's all there in the Bible, right? Well, now we're getting the disclosures from government about the relationship with extraterrestrials. So I really think this thing about faith, Russell, is about where we are as an advancement of our species. I think we are past the childhood storybooks, and the Bible is a storybook. However wonderful it is a storybook. It's a book full of stories. Past the storybook, and we are now ready to understand the truth or the reality of those stories, what they really mean in real time to the people of this planet, to the human race, and our relationship with the universe.
Right. Now, when I look at, Matthew 7:7, it says, in effect, ask and it shall be given you. Seek and you shall find. Knock and it shall be opened unto you. And I look at Matthew 7:8, Matthew 8 says, for everyone that asks, receiveth, and he that seeketh, findeth, and to him that knock, it will be open. To me, that's, for the people in the business world, the people who are doing things, the people who are out there helping the rest of humanity, is that all clear to you? I mean, does that all make sense, that we must ask, we must seek, we must...
Right.
Yeah. Go ahead.
That's, yeah. That, I think that is absolutely the key. It's the key to understanding your spiritual growth and your success in every level of life. If you don't ask, there's nobody there just giving it away, because why would you ask a question? You ask a question because you have thought about something and there is something that you don't quite understand. Therefore, you ask, and you generally ask someone who you believe knows better than you and can maybe give you an answer to whatever the problem is. If you are thinking, then you are asking questions. But if you're not asking questions, you're not thinking. You're like the beast in the field without understanding, right? You know where it says, without understanding, we as beasts in the field. Well, the beasts in the field don't question anything. They take their food and, you know, they live through the day and they sleep at night and that's it. So long as they've got a nice sunny day and a grass field, the cows in the field are happy. They're not turning around and asking the farmer, yes, but when can we move into the next field, right? In other words, people who don't ask questions, any questions, and when you ask for something, that in itself is a question. That is something that you feel you need in your life. You need a response to, right? And we are taught to ask. We are taught to ask in the Lord's Prayer. You know, we're taught to ask for our daily bread and for protection against evil and resistance to temptation. We are taught to ask for these things. And Christ says, if a man asks you to go a mile with him, go two. If he asks you for your cloak, give it to him. But if they don't ask, they don't get. If you do not ask, you do not receive. It's that simple. And that right. applies across the board to everything in life. Because okay. asking donates the fact that you are thinking.
Right. Matthew 21:22 says this way. And all things whatsoever you shall ask in prayer, believing, you shall receive. Right?
Right.
And I'm looking at
yeah.
John 14:14. It says, if you shall ask anything in my name, I will do it. Okay.
That's more of a personal promise that Christ made, you know, to anyone who was paying attention and listening to what he was saying. If we ask in his name, if we say, hey, my buddy Jesus said that if I ask you for X, Y, and Z, you'll help me get it, right? That's literally what that means. It's saying exactly the same as if I wanted to do, say, another radio show, and I called some radio station and I said, my friend Russell told me that if I mentioned his name and I asked you, you'd probably let me go on your show, right? See, it's using Christ's name in exactly that way. That's what he intends for anybody to do. He's like the good reference. If you can reference his name and understand that he's willing to help you, then he's going to back you up every time. We need to take these things that the Bible tells us more literally. We need to understand them in a logical, literal way. Belief or your spirituality, the journey of your soul, the expansion of your soul, and the evolution of you as an eternal being requires that you think about what you say and do, and that you understand it, that you make the effort at least to try and understand all these things that you read, and especially a book of instruction like the Bible, because the Bible is a book of instructions as well as being a lot of stories. It's, if you like, it's full of stories about history, right? The history of, you know, the Jewish people, and it's the history of the human race, the history of Homo sapien, and it's the instruction manual in the New Testament from the history of Christ, the story of Christ, his story or history, right? So we should try and make the effort to understand it. And I think a real clue here is, again, certain words that we use. One of the things that comes up sometimes is when you use the word create, who do we think the creator is? And in fact, who do we think Satan is? Because in the Bible, you've got reference to God, and then much further on, you've got reference to Satan, right? You know, tempting Christ for 40 days in the desert and so on, right? So are we then saying, well, there are two gods, a God of the heavens and a God of the underworld? No, I don't think we're saying that at all. I think that we can reasonably say that there is one source, one capital G God, right, that caused the creation of everything, the prime mover, the prime cause, the one, right? Now, we don't know what that one is. We can have ideas, we can have theories, we can have cosmologies about it all, but nobody actually knows. Single way that it is possible to understand the infinite with a finite brain. That's an oxymoron. You simply cannot do it. So what people have done throughout history is talk about God as if they knew who and what God was. And they've created this whole persona for a God. And they've taken that persona from the reading of the Bible or whatever book they've been reading and expanded on that into religions. Whether it has any accuracy or not, it seems to be beside the point. And I would make a suggestion here, because I don't think there is a God that created everything and then a Satan. That would make two gods. That is an oxymoron from all both spiritual and scientific understanding of the way the universe works. Unless you are referring to God as the quantum presence of both good and evil, the opposite ends, but then that does not sit right, because the God force, the creative force we understand as the one, is in fact the point of balance, which is neither good nor evil. It's encompassing absolutely everything and creates everything. So I think we need to think of existence, the one, the God, the creative force brought everything that exists into existence. Now, once there is everything that is in existence, then from those existing things, we and others can create. And we do. In the simplest terms, for example, we create cookery recipes. We create knitting patterns. We create gardens. We create designs for houses. We create airplanes. We create spaceships. But we are creating out of that which already exists. We are not creating something new. Nothing since the beginning of time has ever been created new, right? We are creating out of that which already exists, which was brought into existence by the source, by the God, by the ultimate creator. So within this space of creating things out of that which already exists, it is quite possible that in our storytelling, our path of understanding, we have created, if you like, lesser gods, small g gods, in other words, beings who can do magnificent, wonderful things, but are not creators. They are simply creating out of that which already exists. And in that context, then the Bible makes sense. Then it is perfectly possible to have a God in heaven, which means up in the sky somewhere, literally, and they Satan, the God, the Lord of hell in the netherworld, which means down in a big black hole, essentially. Even Earth could be seen as the netherworld with the heavens above us and the earth below us. So then the Bible can make sense and can be taken more literally. But that's just an idea that I'm putting out there that might be worth thinking about, that we might open our eyes to a different perspective of those things which are written in the stories of the Bible, including the history of humanity. At the beginning, the book of Genesis, for example, is a much more ancient story than the actual time that the Bible was written. By thousands of years, the stories of the beginning were on the planet and being told orally as stories, and actually been written in clay tablets before the flood. So these are very ancient stories, and we could maybe better understand them if we understand the separation between those whom we call gods in books like the Bible and the actual creator of everything that exists, which is something or someone or some entity which is unknown and unknowable. But if we think down a little lower than that, then we can begin to get understanding of the stories that are being told to us, and they make sense.
Mm-hmm. I'm also looking at John 15:7. It says, if ye abide in me and my words abide in you, ye shall ask what ye will, and it shall be done unto you. So that's in the same light. And I'm looking at Mark 11:24. It says, therefore I say unto you, what things soever ye desire when ye pray, believe that ye receive them, and ye shall have them. How would you interpret that?
That I would say that is really straightforward instruction. It's a matter of taking things for granted. And it really is talking about the world of quantum physics, about which I know next to nothing. But I know that it is the principle that if you put something out there and then let it go with the absolute certainty that it will return to you as it should, then that's what happens. And it is about quantum entanglement. It is about two things being separated and both acting equally at the same time, no matter how far apart they are. So when you put something out into the universe, like for instance, if you say, my husband is really sick, and I need you to help him. You put that out as a prayer, if you like. Prayer is asking. Praying is asking, right? So you put it out as an asking. I'm asking you to help me with this problem, right? And then you let it go. You don't hang on to it. You don't keep going back every 5 minutes and saying, when are you going to answer? Is there any result? No, no, no. You put it out there with the certainty of mind that it will be heard and it will be answered. And it does. It's like a boomerang. It comes right back and the prayer is answered. The asking receives an answer. Not always the answer we want. And that's the key, right? But you put it out. You know in your mind you will get an answer. So you forget about it. It's just the same as when you mail a letter to somebody asking them to come to dinner. And you wait for the RSVP to turn up. But you don't think every minute of every day, will they come, won't they come, will I get an answer, won't I? No. You send the invitation and you wait for the answer, knowing that an answer will come. Taking it for granted. In life, we should never take our friends and neighbors for granted. But the one thing we should take for granted, and so seldom do, is our connection to the creative forces of this universe and the fact that we are perennially tied to them, and that when we put a request out to those forces, we will always get an answer. When we can learn to take that for granted, which is what that piece you were just reading to us says, when we can do that, that removes a whole load of problems from life.
I'm also looking at Mark 9:23. This is another area. Jesus said unto him, if thou can believe, all things are possible to him that believe. And then in Matthew 21:21, verily I say unto you, if ye have the faith and doubt not, ye shall not only do this which is done to the fig tree, but also if you shall say unto this mountain, be thou removed, and be thou cast into the sea, it shall be done. And all things, whatsoever ye ask in prayer, believing, you shall receive. So both of them saying about the same thing. Can we say that? It's true.
Yes. Yes. Absolutely. Definitely.
All right. And finally, I'm going to go to another one. Right in that light, it says, for verily I say unto you, that whatsoever you say unto this one, no, I read that one. Yeah, okay, good. Okay, we got that. So it's all about the asking that I started with 30 minutes ago. Matthew 7:7, ask and it should be given unto you. Seek and you shall find, and knock and it shall be opened unto you.
Yes.
That for everyone who asks, receiveth, and he that seeketh, findeth, and to him that knocketh, it will be opened. So these are the instructions. Go ahead. Right?
These are instructions, and there is something really, really important to comprehend here. Several times in previous conversations, Russell, we have talked about the qualities needed to advance the soul, and they are basically humility and unconditional love, right? Now, in order to ask for something in life, you have to have a degree of humility. It's hard to ask. It's great to be the giver in any situation, because what happens when we can be generous, when we can give things to people, it makes us feel good, right? But it humbles us when we have to ask. And the more difficult the things are, the harder it is to ask for them. Even when they're asking, we're just asking God, and it's pretty secret between him and us, right? It's still humiliating in a degree of one level or another to have to ask for things. We all like to be independent. We all like to be self-sufficient. We don't like to be the beggars, right? We like to be the magnanimous ones who can give rather than the ones on our knees begging for help. Right? And so this is a great thing about asking, that when we learn to ask, we are also learning humility. And this is fundamental to our spiritual growth, to our soul's growth. And when we come to recognize that we have nothing, absolutely nothing of worth in ourselves without asking, then we are really moving well in our spiritual growth. We're really getting a sense or a feeling of what humility really is. Humility is not some false behavior, and it's not some pretense. And it's not humble of us to be asking God to be responsible for all our actions. No, we have responsibility for everything that we say and do in this material world. We are responsible for our behavior. But we also have to have the humility to realize that no matter how clever we are, how much money we have, how many degrees we have, how helpful we are to other people, how charitable we are, how much of our money we give away to help the poor, et cetera, that counts for nothing unless we are willing to get on our knees, so to speak, and ask the Creator for assistance from higher authority, because we all need it. We all need to ask. So the man asking for a cloak because he was cold and wanted something to cover him, right? The man asking them to go for a friend to walk a mile with him. These souls were teaching us how to be humble, how to recognize that no matter how great we seem in the world, in comparison with the Creator, we are next to nothing. So we can be nothing and great at the same time. And that's that middle road, which is not extreme in either way. That's a straight road that we need to walk that leads to unconditional love and our soul's evolution.
All right, Rob, look at giving, if you will. It says in Luke 6:38, give and it shall be given unto you, pressed down and running over full. With the same measure you give, it will be given to you.
Right.
In the same light of that, in Ecclesiastes 11:1, it says, cast thy bread upon the waters, for it shall, you will find it in many days. And finally,
yes,
Corinthians 9:6, he which soweth sparingly shall also reap sparingly, and he which soweth bountifully shall also reap bountifully. Could you go over that with us?
Yes, I think that's exactly what I think we've just been talking about.
Okay.
That you have to do all you can to the best of your ability, whilst recognizing that no matter how much you do, paired to the love of God for his creation and all the gifts that are given to us for nothing, for free, right? Life itself and the wonderful planet to experience it on and other humans to experience it with. The great gifts of the universe are our brains, our minds, our ability to think and choose and understand. What great gifts these are. What can we give away? If we gave away everything we owned, how could it compare with our ability to be thinking creatures on a planet as beautiful as planet Earth? How could that gift compare? Because no matter what we give, we cannot give life. And we are given life as a free gift. So I think that's what that is saying, you know, that no matter how much you've given away, you always get more back than you give. And that's true. And I think in a really mundane way, we learn that lesson, that the kinder we are to other people, the more kindness we seem to receive in return. The more help we give to other people, the more help seems to come to us. So, yes, this is the way it works.
Mm-hmm. It follows along when it says Galatians 6:7, for whatsoever man soweth, that he shall also reap. And then when I'm looking at, finally, it is more blessed to give than it is to receive in Acts 20:35.
Mm-hmm.
So that falls in.
Yes, I think that's saying the same thing. And it is more blessed to give than to receive, in the context that if you are constantly receiving and not doing any giving, then you're not being blessed. That's the opposite of being blessed. And so, yes, I think that's what that's telling you.
Well, there's one that may be a challenge for us. It says in Malachi 3:10, Bring your tithes into the storehouse, and I will open the windows of heaven and pour you out a blessing that there shall not even be room enough to receive it. So aren't we challenged there in that statement?
Bring your tithes to the storehouse, and I will open a window to heaven and bring you, what was it bringing you?
And pour you out blessings that there shall not even be room enough to receive it.
Okay. Right. That's telling you the same thing, isn't it? That when you give, heaven gives 10 times as much to you as you can ever give to anybody else. Essentially, that's what it's telling you. It's what we were just saying. And you remember that in the old days, when they didn't have income tax, they had tithing, right? You gave a tenth of all that you brought into your home. You gave a tenth of it up for charity, and the church took care of that money. The church took care of the charity, and this went on for a very long time until the government started taxing over and above, and it got too much for people to pay in both places. So people stopped tithing it to a large degree to the churches, besides which they saw the churches did it for their own glorification. The money did not go to feed the poor generally. It went to buy, you know, new gold ornaments for the priests. So people got a bit sick of that. But tithing as an original thing in biblical times was a form of taxation, a duty to help the poor.
Old man Rockefeller, senior, he's always give dimes away. Did you remember that story back in the turn of the century?
No, I don't know that story. What is it?
No. He always, as he went among the people, he always gave everybody a dime. He had a pocket full of dimes. But anyway, I'm looking at the third epistle of John. Epistle of John, the third epistle. It says, Beloved, I wish above all things that thou mayest prosper and be in health, even as thy soul prospers. So it's wishing upon people who follow the word a good life, if you will.
Right.
Okay. So when, after reading all of that, when you look at saving Jesus, is he stressing? I haven't read the book, by the way, so I'm asking you, is he talking about those essential elements for us to follow and to internalize and make it part of our lives?
Okay. Yes. In that book, what he does is chapter by chapter, from the beginning to the end, he walks you through a process of, I want to say for most people, new understanding of ancient truths, the result of which is that you now understand not only that Christ meant it when he said everything I can do, you can do and more, but also you now know how to do it. And that's what that book does for you. You know, there's lots, we're all familiar with that statement of Christ. He said it three times, and we all know it, right? So the sayings are not unusual to us, but you look around and you say, okay, Christ, you said I can do everything you can do and more, so how do I do it? And there's nowhere in the New Testament that it tells you exactly how to do it. And there's no other book I've ever read that tells you exactly how to do it. There's millions of self-help books out there, books telling you to do mantras and affirmations and heaven knows what, yogis and yoga and all kinds of things, right? But none of them actually explain and teach you how to fulfill that promise of Christ that you could do everything he does and more. And when you read the Saving Jesus book and you understand it, I mean, you have to pay attention to what it's saying, but it's spelled out loud and clear. Right? This is the process, and this is what you do. And that enables you to do what Christ could do, whatever it is, healing, doing the thing it tells you in the Bible, physician, heal thyself, right? Healing yourself, healing other people, if that's what you do. If you're a healer, it will make you a better healer. If you just want to heal yourself, it will give you the skill to heal yourself. If you want to be any of the things that Christ could do, if you want to walk on water, because it's telling you the underlying principle. It's more than telling you, it's teaching you the underlying principle of how to do those things. And it is unbelievably simple. When you read the book, it is so simple, you think, oh my heavens, how did I not understand this before? It's amazing.
Okay. I'm looking also, as we come to the end of this hour, because I want to get into the next hour, but in John 15:16, of course, 14:12, you say, very, verily, verily, I say unto you, he that believeth on me, the works that I do shall he do also, and greater works than these shall he do. So what I've done in my life pales in comparison to what you are able to do if you follow the dictums, the rule, the precepts that I've passed on to you. But in 15:16, he says, ye have not chosen me, but I have chosen you and ordained you that ye should go forth, bring good fruit, and that your fruit shall remain. That whatsoever you ask the Father in my name, he may give it you. So he's commissioning us to go forward when we decide, well, I'm going to open a church. I want to be the Latter-day Saints. I want to be the Science of Mind, Unitarian Universal Fellowship for Peace and Justice, whatever we want to do in the ministry in his name. We're given that license to do that. Is that where we are?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Okay. What do you see yourself doing? What is your calling, if you don't mind sharing with us? What do you think you were brought here to do in this world, this time, this place? You.
Oh. Well, that's a lot of personal stuff, Russell,
okay.
And maybe not suitable. But as far as the work is concerned, I really, you know this about me, that all my life I've had contact with extraterrestrial beings who are also associates of the Lord, you know, of Christ, and that it has been my lifetime's habit to try and do to the best of my ability everything that they have asked me to do. And that has aspected all areas of my life, not just any particular thing in my life, just simply to listen to what I'm asked to do and to try my best to do it. And I think that whether we perceive that as being our own soul's calling or someone answering our prayers or being in direct contact with extraterrestrial beings. I had an Indian friend and he used to say good, clean and holy spirits. And I think that's a good way of thinking about it, because you certainly don't want to be communicating with the dark side unless it happens to be your work to deal with them. Hopefully not. So I have not personally had any ambitions of my own.
Okay.
I have just tried to do what has been asked of me.
Okay. How do they communicate with you, the beings from the other side?
Well, the same as you're communicating with me now.
Uh-huh. But
right
now,
you're the other side of some radio thing that I don't understand how that works. I know that you are thousands of miles away from me, and yet I can hear you perfectly well. And in the same way, when these beings wish to communicate with me, they can communicate with me in just the same way. Interestingly enough, I hear you on the phone with both my ears, predominantly my right ear. But when I'm talking with extraterrestrial beings, I predominantly hear them in the left ear. So that's a really practical piece of the communication. But also throughout my life, I have been privileged to be contacted by many beings and being shown, had many visionary experiences, had angelic beings take me out of body into my spirit body and take me to various things in the universe. So there have been many, many ways of communication throughout my life with those who are not seen as physically real on this planet at this time. It's not because they're not real beings, just that they're not down here. They're at the other end of a very long phone line, if you like. But they are certainly always around, not just me, but everybody. You know,
okay. We
all have our spiritual guides and helpers who are constantly trying to do their best to assist us and lead us forward in the path which is the best way for us to go. And some of us who've been, let's say, playing the game a lot longer, well, we get to work for them. They're not spending their time so much leading us forward as saying, okay, you are now kind of a postgraduate class before you go back and do your PhD, you know, your postgraduate from your BSc or whatever, and you're now interning. And that's people like me who are here more like employees. We are working for spirit. We are working for extraterrestrial beings.
Right.
And we're just their workers on the planet.
So you hear them as you hear, like, for instance, I'm talking to you on the microphone here, and you're on the...
I'm sorry, your phone's breaking up, Russell.
Okay, can you hear me now?
That's better, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I'm talking to you, and you are saying you can hear me and understand me.
Yes.
So when you
yes.
talk to the other beings on the other side, extraterrestrials, if I may, you can hear them as you hear me?
Yes.
A voice in your head?
Absolutely. Yes.
Huh.
A long time ago, a very, very long time ago, when I was young, we didn't have microwaves. We didn't have cell towers for the microwave, you know, to press those tiny waves. We didn't have any cell towers. We didn't have these kind of wireless, you know, Wi-Fi communications and things. And at that time, many of these extraterrestrial beings who are in physical form themselves would actually teleport down to the planet and visit me when I was young. They would come in person and talk to me. But with the advent of microwave, it became much more difficult. They described it as trying to get through concrete to teleport up and down to this planet. And now that we're completely covered with G4s and now G5s, it's virtually impossible. Ultimately, they could, but it would take a huge amount of the universe's energy, which they're not going to waste doing it, to teleport up and down now, except in a few remote areas. Lucky for me, I'm in a fairly remote area, so communication is still verbally, audibly, pretty open. We don't have many cell towers in the state of Montana, thank goodness. But nonetheless, these frequencies have trapped humanity. They've especially G5. Now, since the advent of G5, we are hearing all this now about new channelers, you know, people channeling. And I would have to ask them, were I talking to them, where are you channeling from? Where is your communicant speaking to you from? Because it's really difficult for the higher beings to get through to planet Earth right now. I think possibly the reason that we are seeing these young channelers is because they have been born with a different kind of brain, that they already have, as it were, a different kind of receiving station built into the brains than, say, somebody old like me. I'm an old model, and it's difficult now to communicate. But with the younger people, communication is easier because they have been born with a different brain modality to start with. I think that must be the case.
All right. And that very well could possibly be. I'm asking, so when they beamed themselves down to talk to you, did you see them?
Yeah, oh, yes. Yeah. Absolutely. Right up until we had G4, up to 20 years ago, they were still sending holographic images, and they still do. They still can send holographics, but they don't come themselves anymore.
But they were able to beam themselves down to walk among
you? Yes, absolutely, yes.
And did you see them like you see other people, or like trees or plants,
yes,
or dogs or cats? See them? Is that right?
Yes, when they're standing in your room, that you see them. Just the same as I would see you if you were standing here.
Wow. And then when they talk to you, was it by telepathy, or was it by you could hear the voice in your head, or what's going on?
Just like
out.
I'm hearing you now in my ears. I've got ears, right? So I would hear them with my ears.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes they do communicate now in this time frame, of this present time frame that we're in now. They are communicating with me telepathically. I was communicating with them telepathically just before this radio show. Did you get the little message I sent you? I text you a message right before, you know, like half an hour before we came on the show. I texted you a little message.
I see.
And it said that you read it, right? You saw that little tiny message. Well, that was to do with a piece of telepathic information that I just got. So, yes, telepathically, they communicate all the time.
I see. But for those of us who have never been contacted and heard voices in our heads, like you, or have awakened in the middle of the night to see somebody standing there that we communicate with, I've never had that in my life. And there are people like me. Why are we laughing?
You know, I'm laughing because you say that, right? The only reason, it's not because you are not able to see. First of all, I don't hear voices in my head. Telepathic communication is not an out loud communication in your head. It's like the words are there and the knowing is there. And there's usually a picture to go with it. But when people hear voices in their head, that is often a sign of a mental disorder or a brain disorder, right? Generally speaking, that's when you hear things, you hear them in your ears, not just in your, it's different, Russell. So
well,
I don't hear people talking in my head, right?
I beg to differ. What's the difference? If I say that I've never heard anybody talking in my head, speaking to me, and you say that someone is always contacting you. As a matter of fact, you see them. You see the entities in the middle of the night or whenever you see them. I've never seen anybody. Let's say it that way.
Yeah, I understand what you are saying, but what I am saying to you is that if you don't hear them, And if you don't see them, it's because there is no reason for you to hear them or see them at this point in time. It's, in other words, how could I be a clairvoyant talking about invisible things if I couldn't see them? I have to be able to see them. It's the work I do. It's my job to see them. But okay. Maybe it's not your job at this point in time. Maybe your job is about something different, right?
Okay.
So when you see and hear these things, it's because it's relevant to your soul's work on the planet at this time. Everybody has the ability to communicate telepathically. We don't, because language is easier for us. Everybody has the ability to see spirits. We don't, generally speaking, because it's not a necessary part of our experience at this point in time. That's all. It's not because some people are special and some people are not. We all have the same ability. Now, it is true to say that all these so-called spiritual gifts of clairvoyance, clairaudience, you know, whatever, clear thinking, clear seeing, clear hearing, all these things are specific vibratory frequencies. And that some people have not yet evolved in their living experiences to the point where they can reach those frequencies. It takes many lifetimes to develop those skills and abilities. But when we have developed those skills and abilities, it still does not mean they will be necessary in this particular lifetime.
But didn't Edgar Cayce use those abilities? Did he not, Edgar Cayce?
Well, he used some abilities. He obviously was not capable in himself of reaching all those frequencies, because he would go into a semi-conscious trance state, I understand, in order to bring his messages forward. He, as a physical being in that particular lifetime, was not capable of reaching the frequency in the full conscious mind.
But you can.
Yes, as a clairvoyant. Because clairvoyance activates in the ultraviolet frequency. So anybody who has learned to reach that clairvoyant frequency, that ultraviolet frequency, can see clairvoyancy. Uh-huh. It's all a matter of frequency. And it's not a matter of goodness. This is something that's really important to understand. Just because somebody like me can their mindset into a clairvoyant mode and do all the things that clairvoyants do,
doesn't mean
that they are good or holy. It means that they have learned the skill.
All right, explain to us, what's the difference between the average person and a clairvoyant? What's the difference?
No difference at all, except one has learned to do something that the other has not yet chosen to do. And maybe they've already learned it, but don't want to do it in this lifetime.
What have you learned to do that, let's say, the average person has not learned to do? Because the average person is not a clairvoyant.
The single thing you have to learn to do, and it takes a long time to learn, is shut down your every personality. Every person has a persona. That persona, that personality, has an ego, right, that supports it. Our sense of self, we all have it. That's what holds us together as a person in a physical lifetime. What the clairvoyant learns to do is to set that aside, totally move out of self-consciousness into consciousness of that which is before them but separate from them, and empty their mind of all self-concern in order to be able to deal with the concerns of another person. So it's really the one thing, that's the one thing that a clairvoyant does, is set aside ego and empty the mind of all. It's like if you're working, for example, as a clairvoyant, but you have not learned to do that, you could be looking at somebody else's life and seeing something in that life that would affect you. And then you're going to say something different to that person based on how it affects. That is absolutely a no-no. You're not, there's no purity in that at all. You have to be able to set self or ego aside completely in order to relate to somebody else's life. You know, it's the kind of the thing about walking in somebody else's shoes. You have to be able to mentally walk in somebody else's shoes. And you also have to be able to look down the timeline, see their history, see their future, see their present situation. And you have to be able to look at them physically and see their energy field and their state of health and so on. So these are all learned things.
And you were saying the difference between the average person who hasn't been able to do those things and people like you, a clairvoyant, would be the many times they have come in and out of existence, been reincarnated on planet Earth. Is that the difference?
Not necessarily, Russell.
Oh.
There could be a soul that is way more advanced as a spiritual, eternal, immortal being who is coming for their second or third incarnation onto this planet because they have no real history with planet Earth, no real history maybe even with sensory perceptions at all, right? And they just want to experience that. But they are not going to use or manifest any esoteric skills in that lifetime because they don't want to. When you say it the way you're saying it, you're making it a judgment thing, as if I or people like me have done something special that other people haven't done. And that is not true. We could have 100 people around us who are living 100% materialistic lives at this moment in time. Their entire focus is on their learning through the material, right? So they're into careers, they're into education, they're into making money, they're into being philanthropists, they're into being politicians, whatever it is. That is the life they've experienced, they're experiencing and learning from. But from a point of view of spiritual capability to manifest the skills that I am currently manifesting in this life, they could be light years ahead of me. Just because somebody is not choosing to do something in a lifetime does not mean they're not capable of doing it.
Mm-hmm. How about the people who do remote viewing? I know that's a science that Ingo Swann and Hal Puthoff and some others have made the science of it back in the 60s and 70s and the 80s. And the government has really made that a science.
The difference as far as I can understand it, and I have met people who've been to the government programs and were very good at doing remote viewing. However, those who learn to do it as a more of an intellectual technique or a physical reality with no spiritual connotation whatsoever, in other words, those who learn to do it under the government program, for example, they learn to throw their mind to a distant place, to observe that distant place, take detail, read documents, do whatever they do, come back with that information. That is a skill which is teachable, in my experience, in like 10 minutes, right? It's a very simple, Oh, yes, it takes me. It's a very, very simple thing to teach somebody to do. There are specific steps that you do, and you can recite those steps in 10 minutes, and then the person has to go away and practice doing it until they get good at it. The problem with that is that there is no spiritual context. They are just sending out like a piece of their mind, like a little camera from their mind, going out, making a recording, and coming back with that recording. And like all other camera recordings, there is no emotion in it. There is no understanding in it. So they might, for instance, a remote viewer trained by the government, and the government says, okay, there are some people having a meeting in that castle in Switzerland. We want you to go and see who's at the meeting and what they're talking about. So they can go, they can cast their mind, this piece of their mind. They can say, okay, there are five people at this meeting. They're talking about X, Y, and Z. And their time frame is next month, right? They come back, they repeat that information. That's spying. That's information gathering. And that's what remote viewing can do, and do very successfully. What a clairvoyant can do is go to that same meeting, say, oh, yes, there are five people here. Now that one, Mr. X, the second from the left, he is here because his motivation is da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And the next man, he is here because his motivation is so-and-so. And man number three really is only here spying for somebody. In other words, a clairvoyant can also know by being empathetic with the people the reasons behind things, the causes, the purposes, which government remote viewing cannot do. It doesn't do.
Why? May I ask why?
Why what?
Why can't they do it? I mean, I was looking at the motion picture paycheck.
Because they're just doing a learned thing. They're just doing a learned thing. It's like the difference between somebody learning to ride a bicycle and somebody who rides the bicycle understanding how to build a bicycle, how to maintain a bicycle, and how to become a champion rider with that bicycle. It's a whole world of difference. Because there is an emotional or spiritual component with the clairvoyant that does not exist with the government agent.
Uh-huh. But from what I've been reading, but Ingo Swann had several books out, and Russell Targ, whatever his name is, and others, Hal Puthoff. Those people had made it a real science that's like 99.99% accurate in terms of what they can do. You agree?
Yes,
okay.
I would agree.
Well,
and they are often more detail accurate than a clairvoyant would be.
Uh huh. Okay.
They would be better at doing things like reading documents, were in some other location, or the numbers of vehicles, than I would be. A lot more accurate, but they wouldn't understand why the documents were there, or why the people were meeting, or what was the cause of it.
And you believe that you can teach that within 10 minutes for people who want to concentrate?
Like the government does, yes.
Okay, all right.
Doing it like a clairvoyant takes another whole process of learning.
I see.
So yes,
you can
learn it.
I see. So you as a clairvoyant, you can do those kind of things. Yes or no?
Yes, I used to. My brain's too tired now. I can't focus like I used to.
Basically, if you learn how to swim, you always know how to swim. You ride a bicycle.
Yes,
you always...
I know. Well, when I was young, when I was 11, I got my mile swim certificate. I don't think I could swim the length of a swimming pool now. Right?
I see. Okay.
So as we get old, we lose a lot of these skills, including visual acuity on all levels.
So if you don't use it, you lose it.
I'm just not as good as I used to be, and I know I'm not. That's why I don't do readings anymore.
I see.
Because I can no longer guarantee their accuracy.
I see. Okay. But how about telepathy? How does one acquire telepathy? Listen, here's a question. On this planet, most of the people are not able to read minds, telepathy, you know, use telepathy, right? But if I were to go to Andromeda, or let's do it differently, if I would go to the Pleiades, if I would go to wherever the Anunnaki come, wherever they come from, whatever planet, Nibiru, what is that planet? Nibiru,
yeah.
Right. So if I were to go there, all the entities on those different planets that I just described use telepathy, and they know what everyone else is thinking. Yes or no?
No.
No?
No. Most extraterrestrial species use language. A few of them use language in preference to telepathy. Most of them develop a high degree of telepathy, but they don't use it.
But they have their ability, right? Oh, yes. Yes or no?
Yeah. They have the ability. So do we, but we don't use it.
But wait a minute. I don't know too many people that I've met in my lifetime, my few years, have been able to use telepathy.
We have the ability, but we don't use it.
Do you have that ability?
You have to practice. It takes skill. Skill is to, I could never use it because I don't have the patience to develop that particular skill.
Do you know anybody?
It requires a huge.
Here's the question. Do you know anybody?
Actually, yes, I do, or I did. And that was a dear friend of mine who died some years ago. And she could read anybody's mind at the drop of a hat. Absolutely.
Okay, excellent. That's a teachable skill?
Well, if you learn all the other skills first, telepathy is one of the hardest skills to learn because it requires total self-discipline. Reading somebody else's mind is really, especially on this planet, it's a big no-no. It's a total invasion of privacy. You are not supposed to do it.
God love you. That's just a rule. I'm talking about the reptilians, people in the cabal, people in Illuminati. They don't follow those rules that you talk about.
That's true.
Okay.
It doesn't make them right.
They do it all the time. Yes or no?
Well, I doubt it.
You doubt it? You tell me reptilians don't have that ability.
Oh, the reptilians. But the reptilians are an alien species with a completely different set of parameters to everything that is human among all other species. You've heard me say this so many times, because they don't belong in our universe.
Fine.
Reptilians do not belong here.
Well, let's tell it like it is. They have the ability to read people's minds. They can shapeshift. They can do all of those kinds. Yes or no?
Yes.
Okay. All right. And they do it all the time, but that's part of how they maintain control over the rest of the species.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And that's why it's a
forbidden thing, because they're not supposed to be doing that.
Because it's considered a bad thing. You keep talking about what they're not supposed to do, but I'm looking at all these people, be it a reptilian, be it a gray, be it Nordic, blue avian, and even Palladians, they don't all follow that prescription that you talked about.
Okay. Well, they can't, and neither can they all do it. They can't all do the things that you're talking about.
William Tompkins said they could. He said the people who contacted him and did it all the time with him.
Exactly. The people who contacted him could communicate with him telepathically because they contacted him and got his permission. If somebody is doing the interacting with humans without first contacting them and asking their permission, then they are from the dark side and they have no business doing it. That's because what I'm telling you is true, Russell. The reptilians are intrinsically evil.
The reptilians, the draconians. May I? Because you keep saying that over and over and over and over again, and I hear you 1,000 times, okay? They are despicable, they're diabolical, they're nefarious, and whatever adjective you want to conjure up to make the dark side just, you know, an anathema. How's that? Okay, we got that. Now, I am saying that there are people, entities on this planet who come here, and they use all of those so-called don't use these things on the human being or the homo sapiens, but they do that all the time, right?
Yes, the bad ones do.
Okay, the bad ones, whatever. But they have the ability to use those things, and they do it all the time. Did you ever see the motion picture? I'm trying to get. Did you see Hearts in Atlantis?
No.
Okay. All right.
No.
All right. Anthony Hopkins played the role. For anyone who's listening, watch Hearts in Atlantis and watch what Anthony Hopkins will watch what he does and what he will do in those when he gets ready. Okay. That's one. You have watched Taken, right?
Yes.
Okay. And Taken, when that crash happened, was that entity able to shapeshift?
I don't remember in the movie.
Well, it was 13 hours of that movie, but he did shapeshift. He took the form of a human being when it was the crash happened, and he escaped from the crash. And he stayed on the planet for many a decade, watching people grow and helping them to do whatever. And he used those abilities over and over and over and over again. So anyone who wants to know what I'm talking about, get the motion picture Taken. It's a 13-hour miniseries by Steven Spielberg. And would you say that 90% of what was in that 13-hour miniseries was true?
Yes.
Okay.
It was a very good miniseries. There was a lot of true things in it.
It was excellent. One of the best.
Yes.
So what they have done, and they are still doing, since disclosure is upon us, and we have to talk about disclosure. Let's do a little bit of it since we have a few minutes. Ronald Reagan wanted to know about UFOs and the crash entities that people were taking and put him into, I don't know, cordon off in certain areas. They wouldn't give him that information. And this is what he said about that.
In our obsession with antagonisms of the moment, we often forget how much unites all the members of humanity. Perhaps we need some outside universal threat to make us recognize this common bond. I occasionally think how quickly our differences worldwide would vanish if we were facing an alien threat from outside this world. And yet, I ask you, is not an alien force already among us?
Okay, comment on that for me. What was he talking about?
Well, first of all, we have to remember that was a very political speech. It was when he was trying to get funding for his Star Wars program, you know, that thing he wanted to do.
He was talking
so
about
it
aliens
was a really,
on the planet.
Yeah, it was a really good political speech. But he was also, I think, referencing the fact that there were extraterrestrials on the planet and that he couldn't find out about them, but he was wanting to let everybody know that there was something that we should be trying to find out about. So, yeah, I like Ronald Reagan. And that was a brilliant speech that he made.
Certainly. But he had information about the aliens that he wouldn't give us as a president. A little bit of information he wouldn't disclose.
Well, he was hinting at it. He was hinting at it.
But he knew something, but he wouldn't get on the radio on television and disclose it because they told him, if you do, you're in trouble, right?
Yes, they probably would have killed him.
Okay, like they did JFK.
You know,
now watch this. Watch
yeah.
this. JFK had that information, and he started collecting his information in the early 40s when he understood the Germans were being contacted by the Draco forces, the dark forces, and giving that information. And he knew that, and because James Forrester, Secretary of State, Defense, whatever he was, he had that information and he passed some to Kennedy. But anyway, let's go to the book by Dr. Michael Sella, and he talks about JFK and that information that JFK knew but they didn't want him to have.
How plausible is the idea that Kennedy was assassinated because of his efforts to learn about UFOs and extraterrestrial life? Also, did Kennedy learn about extraterrestrial life during the World War II era as a result of his service with U.S. Naval Intelligence?
Okay. He's asked a question. Was he killed because he challenged those individuals who have that information, the secret forces, the secret CIA, FBI, whatever, above the guys way above? So do you think in that book that he talked about, Kennedy, Eisenhower, and whatever, that that's part of the reason he may have been killed, right?
Oh, yes, I would think that's very probable.
Okay.
Very probable.
Linda also talked about, let me do this. Here's another little clip by JFK about that incident.
He said, I have personally heard the wired audio in the Oval Office with JFK, with MJ1. And he said, you need to know that when John F. Kennedy said, I want every document, every letter, every photograph, every then 16 millimeter film, he asked for everything. That matches the document. I want all files. And I want it brought to this Oval Office and gave them a date. And this man talking to me said, and the answer to the president was, sir, you do not have a need to know. At which point, according to this man, John F. Kennedy, with his voice rising, said, I am President of the United States, and I am your Commander-in-Chief, and I am giving you an order. And if you do not meet the date and the time of my order, I will hold the press conference of not only this century, but all centuries, quote unquote. If that's true, he was murdered because he was a threat to national security as it was analyzed by Alan Dulles, head of the CIA, who was the head of MJ-12, with the charter that no one was to tell the United States or the world that they were dealing with alien intelligences and back engineering alien technology.
Hello. Are we on the same page?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. And some people say everybody gets quiet when this happens because they have murdered a lot of people, right? They have gotten rid of a lot of people who have disclosed that information. Yes or no?
Definitely.
Okay. Okay. And people ask, who are these people? Well, if you got to do a little history, have you done any research on who these people are?
I have read a great deal, but I haven't researched it, no.
What have you read?
Over the years, I've read, you know, about Majestic 12 was all the rage for reading back in the 80s and 90s. And I was fortunate enough to go to the Global Science Conferences in Denver for several years, where a lot of these whistleblowers came out and talked about these things, all the government cover-ups and so on. So for me, it's not conspiracy theories. It's actual facts that are being hidden and kept from the public for a variety of reasons, you know, that the government thinks up. And generally speaking, I don't think it's our Congress members so much as it is the people behind the scenes, many of them who are former members of Congress, I might add. But, you know, the Illuminati, the Bilderbergers, the people who meet every year in Switzerland and plot the fate of humanity. We're not living anymore in a world where people think this never happens. I think most people know that there are hidden bodies of people manipulating our country and all other countries in the world. I think they understand that our economy has been controlled for a long time now by groups of people that are definitely not democratically elected, have nothing to do with elections. They are just people who control things, and that our idea of an elected government is really just superficial icing. It's not the cake that we live by. It's just the disguise icing on the top that gives us the illusion that we have some choice about anything. But I don't think that humans have had real choice on this planet for a very long time now, certainly not since World War II. World War II was really the beginning of the end of democracy worldwide and moving into a one world government republic type of situation where an elite group manage the masses being the 9 billion population of the world.
Uh-huh. So as a planet on the outback of the universe, some people call it a prison planet, and this is what they say.
Yeah, he's
planet.
Really open to disclosure, and I think that is such a hot topic right now. And so he really, I think, reached out to me because I understand that disclosure isn't really... It's not only about ETs. It's kind of about our history as human beings and kind of like how we fit into this earth and why it's important to know that there's ETs, because we know that they are affiliated with humanity in maybe unbenevolent ways. And I feel like he was a big part of that.
Mm-hmm. So what kind of role has ET played in your life?
I guess basically waking me up to the reality of what world I'm in. Because I knew Earth was just, it didn't feel like everything didn't feel right, but I didn't understand it. And I had some visitations where I felt like I was downloaded with information that I understood that this Earth is a very unique place in that we are asleep. And yeah, so they just help wake different things up about our government, about why we have religion and all these different paradigms that we have.
I like what you said. You said that, use the word important. Yeah. Why do you feel they're important, or it's important to know about them? I mean, you've just given a whole list there, but...
Of important to know about the ETs?
Yeah.
Well, basically because history has been rewritten and rewritten all of them out. And they are who we are. And so to rewrite them out of our history, we don't really understand who we are as humans. Mm-hmm. And why we worship the way we worship or why we do the things we do. A lot of the stuff we do is because of what they brought to Earth. Mm. And a lot of the things that are unbenefiting us now as humans and not allowing us to expand are because of other ET races that have chosen to dominate that consciousness and hold us into what people call like a prison planet or prison consciousness. And so that's why it's important.
What do you think? How do you want to comment about what she said?
Oh, I would agree with what she was saying. I'm quite right. It is not so much a prison planet as a prison consciousness. That's what most people have. Most people believe that they are trapped in whatever their lives are because of some outside force. But this is back to self-responsibility. People are never responsible for their own misfortunes. It was always because of something that was done to them or at them. And frequently, of course, the government. And very often it's true. You know, the government is responsible for a great deal of misery on this planet.
Okay. Well, here's another guy. And he talks about aliens and...
Most scientists agree that a finding like this would alter and transform the status quo in many ways. What would be its effect on our society, our science, our technology, or our religion?
So for me, detecting another civilization is a way of coming to a better understanding of who we are as human beings. It would mean a chance to see whether the ways of knowing that we've developed here on Earth, our math, our science, our ways of expressing ourselves, our music, our art, are they somehow tapping into something that goes beyond Earth, or are they uniquely ours?
The discovery would be on the same level as those of Copernicus and Darwin, and as of the transforming events in human history. However, it will be decades before people get used to the idea that we are not alone in the universe, and its real meaning becomes deeply ingrained, as occurred with the heliocentric cosmology and biological evolution.
Would you say that if aliens were here, if there have been agreements with the government of the this government, be it Eisenhower or whomever, or who have met with aliens, if government entities have intervened and stopped that knowledge from passing down to us, do you think that's serious or not?
I think it is extremely important and very serious. It's important to us that the truth, the real truth, is disclosed. Because we are, as a species, humanity, Earth humans, that is, humanity on this planet, we are quickly coming to a geological event, a cosmic event, which definitely requires, and this has been going on building towards this event for some years now, it requires us to make a definitive choice about which way we as individuals want to go. Do we want to go left or do we want to go right? And we cannot truly make that choice unless we have full disclosure of the truth of what it is that we are choosing. Right now, people mostly have no idea. They have woolly ideas of good and evil, woolly ideas of right and wrong, mostly conditioned by either their government or what they see in movies and films, somewhat what they maybe read in books, but no clear picture about what it really means in an eternal sense to have goodness on one side or evil on the other side. And so I think it's incredibly important that all these disclosures come about and come about very quickly. And once they are out there, then people have a fair choice. They have all the information they need, and they can choose in a way which they cannot do now. So, yes, I think it's very important. It's disclosure on every level.
Well, President John F. Kennedy wanted that information, and they circumvented him, and they didn't give him the information. Alan Dulles and I suggest a book by Michael Seller, when he says, the title of that book I don't have in front of me, but he was talking about Eisenhower and Kennedy on the front cover of that book. So the people who want to really delve into this story, people who wanted to do the research and find out what the truth is, which is going to be difficult, since we all denied the truth, even Kennedy
Kennedy's Last Stand is the name of the book,
Kennedy's
Last Stand.
And anybody, very simply read, gets right to the point. Sulla has done a magnificent job at identifying the culprits, if you will, and the hiding the truth. And because towards Kennedy's, 1 week before he died, he said this.
The very word secrecy is repugnant in a free and open society. And we are, as a people, inherently and historically opposed to secret societies, to secret oaths, and to secret proceedings. We decided long ago that the dangers of excessive and unwarranted concealment of pertinent facts far outweighed the dangers which are cited to justify it. Even today, there is little value in opposing the threat of a closed society by imitating its arbitrary restrictions. Even today, there is little value in ensuring the survival of our nation if our traditions do not survive with it. And there is very grave danger that an announced need for increased security will be seized upon by those anxious to expand its meaning to the very limits of official censorship and concealment. That I do not intend to permit to the extent that it's in my control. And no official of my administration, whether his rank is high or low, civilian or military, should interpret my words here tonight as an excuse to censor the news, to stifle dissent, to cover up our mistakes, or to withhold from the press and the public the facts they deserve to know.
Interpret that for us. What was he saying before he died? Help us out a little bit. You read the book.
Yes. I think that was a wonderful speech. And as a good politician, he did leave himself an out, of course, right at the end when, as all politicians do, when he said, you know, information that they had a right to know, because who determines what we have a right to know, right? So in any political scenario, there is always the people at the top always leave themselves an out. But generally speaking, I thought that was a great speech.
Hmm? They killed him. He didn't have an out.
They killed him. They killed him. Yes.
Okay.
They killed him.
He insisted that he got
information. Because he threatened them, didn't he? He threatened them with disclosure insofar as he was able. And so, yeah. You know, there are very powerful forces on this planet who are truly, truly evil. And we have to ask ourselves, what is their goal? Well, in a great big picture, much bigger than anything we normally imagine, the ultimate goal for each human being is to become Christ-like, to do everything that Christ could do and more. And one of the things that Christ could do, potentially we can evolve to do, is he left the planet, he ascended, if you like, and then he came back to visit his disciples, right? And in some ways he was changed, because when he met them on the highway, they didn't recognize him. But they did recognize him at another time, and he dined with them, right? So this tells us something that is not often mentioned, that one of the great gifts of being an immortal being, as Christ was, is that you can manifest a physical body for your use on a physically real planet anytime you wish. And when you have no further requirement from that physical body, you have the capability of disassembling it and moving elsewhere, moving into another form or another body somewhere else. This is the ultimate gift of being an immortal being, that you can move in and out of time and in and out of physicality at will. This is
but
the
people
ultimate
don't even know that.
Gift.
People, honestly, most people don't believe that.
Christ,
most people on this planet don't believe
that. But the Bible
that.
Tells, let's go, you know, back to the church thing. The Bible tells them so.
I am
right?
saying that most people on this planet don't really believe that they have that ability.
Well, I know, and I'm not... I'm not asking.
But how do we save humanity? Listen, let me do this, because we're coming to the close in a few minutes. Only about 10 minutes. But look, Stephen Greer. Do you know Dr. Stephen Greer?
Yes, I know who you mean. I'm familiar with his work.
Okay.
I think he's brilliant.
Okay. Here's what he says is happening.
So these people that you see on 60 Minutes, that you see on Fox News and CNN and all the media, this is the ramping up of the false disclosure that we warned about in 1999 when we wrote the paper, When the Disclosure Serves Secrecy. Why? Because they want people to now know that there are UFOs, but they want to put this big lie out there that they are a national security threat and concern, what Nick Pope and others keep saying. By the way, Nick Pope has admitted to two people on my team that he has been paid large sums of money to say these very scripted things in the mainstream media so that he has been able to buy some really pricey real estate in Soho and London and elsewhere. One of my concerns about this is that while I normally do not engage in sort of gossip, is that now that these people are miseducating deliberately the American people and the world on this, it is a very big concern. They have stepped into another level of deception. It's one thing if you're at a UFO conference in front of 1,000 people. It's another thing if there are millions and millions of people hearing this lie. Now, all these people, from Chris Mellon to Luis Elizondo to Leslie Kane to Nick Pope and others, know for a fact just what I just said, that there are two types of UFO things. Man-made ones, that is the bigger secret, by the way. The ET issue is not as big a secret as the man-made ones for a reason I'll get into in a moment. And that this is not a national security threat. All the images that you have seen in the mainstream news of the Tic Tac, of these pyramids and triangles, those are all ours. And they were filmed and known at some point they would release this to open the door to this subject. But there's more coming. You saw on the History Channel where the Italian helicopter that crash landed after it had some malfunction, that whole event, we know from Paula Harris, who was there and met with the man who's now the admiral who when it is on that show, said that those were our human classified electromagnetic weapons that they were attempting to target UFO ET craft that were in the area at the time. She knows this for a fact and documented it. So almost everything you're seeing that's going out through the mainstream media right now is not only a lie, but a damn lie, which is exactly what Wernher von Braun warned about would eventually happen when he told Carol Rosen that in 1974, and of course, which I learned about in the early 90s and have been warning people about since. Unfortunately, we're going to live through this period of this false launch of information. The only way we're going to correct it is for all of you to share this YouTube video with everyone. I don't care if you rip it off the site and post it elsewhere, do it. Because unfortunately, we're at the point now where there is a massive information campaign that is false. And the reason they want people to think all of these are things that we don't know and can't figure out how they fly is so that eventually they can put out more scary information, perhaps next month with the Director of National Intelligence report, showing even more gruesome events that have happened that show, in fact, that these are a threat to the national security. Why? Of course, that with the fascist military-industrial and industrialist complex want people to be afraid of something. So this is the next big thing. It's much bigger than 9/11. It's much bigger than COVID. We've been warning about it for some time. Unfortunately, we're trying to see if some people can get pulled off the precipice, including Luis Elizondo. That is why Daniel Keene is working with him. Now, I've made it very clear that Daniel Sheehan has told me he would do this, that if he cannot get Luis Elizondo to speak the truth and come clean on this, that he would drop him as a client. He will drop him as a client.
Okay. So obviously it's more to it than most beneath the eyes. It's big. This is big. This is gigantic. And I suggest that people who really are concerned about understanding some degree of what's really happening, go to Dr. Greer's website, the Disclosure Project. You should go to and you should watch another documentary that he put out 2 years ago that 600 million people have watched called Unacknowledged. My case is closed. Any comment from you?
No, I absolutely agree, and I support what Dr. Greer is saying there totally. You know, it's the simple truth. If you want to control something, first you create a fear, and then you provide the solution for that fear. We've seen it with COVID, right? That was so artificial and so frightening, and yet it's controlling the whole of humanity right now, it seems. And we're seeing it also with these disclosures. I 100% agree with Dr. Greer. Please watch his videos. Watch him on YouTube. Listen to what he's saying. He's telling you the truth.
Okay. So look, we have about 5 or 6 minutes left. How do you assess all of this? I mean, you are in contact with people from the Anunnaki, with David and other people on the spaceships. A lot of meetings are being conducted. A lot of strategies are being held. I even think George Green is doing something to help us, where he is, if I may. What can we do? What the average person, what can the average person start thinking about? What can they do? What can they get involved in? Give us some solutions. Give us some help.
Well, you know, for me, it's the same story, Russell. We have to try and gain knowledge. We have to try and seek for the truth. There are many disciplines that tell you, turn your face to the light, look to the light, seek the light. Well, seeking the light is seeking enlightenment. And we get enlightenment through gaining knowledge and understanding. So we have to actively seek it. We have to read the books that tell us these things, like Dr. Sala, like Michael Ledwith. We have to watch the video things that good people like Dr. Greer are putting out. We have to make the effort. It's an individual effort. I mean, just think about it. We've got nearly 9 billion people, and you were talking about, or somewhere in there, was talking about 600 million had seen that video. That's not even a percentage of the population. We need everybody on the planet. And the first and most important thing they can do is look to themselves. In the process of seeking all this knowledge, also at the same time, go within themselves. Find peace in their own lives. Find peace in their own hearts. Find peace in their own attitude towards other people. Get away from discrimination, from judgment, from always saying, you know, somebody else is at fault, always blaming somebody else. start taking responsibility. If every individual on the planet could magically overnight become responsible for themselves, then they would start seeking the information they need and acting upon it.
Okay, let me do
and
this.
We just, that's
do
just
this.
What we have
before
to hope for.
Okay, let me do this. Before. And we did the first hour, and we concentrated on the first hour in terms
well,
of
you know,
if,
yes. What would we do? What can we do? Well, you did bring it to the fore in that first hour. You can ask the Almighty for help. However you perceive your Creator,
let me take it.
Ask for guidance, and then you will receive.
Okay. Ed Tompkins, you know who I'm talking about, right?
Yes.
What do you think about this guy?
William Tompkins.
Yeah.
Is that who you... Yes. I thought that William Tompkins was a very special human being who was chosen by the extraterrestrials to fulfill a very valuable and important function using his life, which he
is
agreed
what he
to
says.
Use
Here's what
in
he
service.
Is what he says.
People all over this planet for at least 6,000 years have been influenced by extraterrestrials, the Dracos and the Reptilians. They have taken the information that is in essentially every school on the planet, and they've modified the information. All history documentation in this country and on every country on the planet have been given lies about astronomy, lies about mathematics, lies about technical capabilities, lies about the universe. You name it, okay? Everything have been lies. Every PhD on this planet, whether they're scientific, whether they're medical, makes no difference. Every book that they read the 6 years they were in the university are lies. They're not telling the truth. They were not taught the truth. At that time, we had 34 admirals in the Navy. All of them had been through Annapolis. They learned how to learn everything about the Navy, everything about history, everything about mathematics, everything about astronomy, you name it. They learned all lies. So who did the Secretary of Navy Forrestal select for this job? Turns out Admiral Riccobata was not an American. He was born in Australia. The Secretary of the Navy selected an Australian man who had not been in...
Thank you, Mr. Tompkins. Now, we have 90 seconds. What would you say, what would you help us to do for the last part of the show? Tell us what to do.
Russell, it's not my job to tell anybody what to do. That would be a gross interference of free will. Right. What I suggest we all try and do is use our free will, use our right to choose, to gain knowledge, to choose, to gain knowledge, to choose, to seek out the truth in our lives on all levels, choose to apply those truths to ourselves and the responsibility that we have for ourselves and for our eternal souls. That's what I would say. So learn to choose wisely.
Okay. Well, I really appreciate you being on and giving us a lot of good information. And we'll do it again at some point in the future. How's that? Okay?
We will. Thank you. Okay. Thank you, Russell.
Well, thanks very much for being
Bye
on.
Now.
Bye now. Blog Talk Radio. And thanks very much for listening. And we'll see you next time, and we'll do the same thing. We'll bring you ProjectDisclosure.com. Have a good one, and talk to you then. Bye now.